night, peering through the veil of darkness. The paranormal, spiritual, and comedic abound. Welcome to the Richard Spazoff Show.
I'd like to thank Christopher Jordan for making that introduction for me. I love it, I'll tell you. It's a nice introduction. What a way to start off today, everybody. You're on the Richard Spazoff Show, brought to you by Audible. And you can find Audible on my website at thepsychicmediumspazoffshow.com. Also, the Richard Spazoff Show's podcast is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family, a podcast available for Android and coming soon iDevices. To get all the great stuff from the Richard Spazoff Show and more, check out HCUniversalNetwork.com. Also, I'd like to give a big thank you to TalkStream Live for bringing us aboard their website. Thank you, Tom, and thank you, Bill, and here's a commercial for them.
Are you intrigued by paranormal talk radio? You'll love the new paranormal radio app from TalkStream Live. You'll find a great selection of talk shows covering UFOs, ghosts, strange phenomena, and much more. Download the paranormal radio app now and start listening to the very best in paranormal talk entertainment, the paranormal radio app. Free in Google Play and the iOS App Store.
Welcome to the Richard Spazoff Show. Tonight's guest, Merle Fankhauser. Hey, Merle.
Hey, Richard.
Good to have you tonight. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me on your show.
Now, to start off with, we both have some, you know how you connect with people in life, right?
Yeah.
I would say, what do you think, what is the cause of that? For me, I could tell you my reason, but why do you feel that we connect with people, sometimes a deep connection and sometimes not so deep?
Well, I've been trying to figure that out for years. And when I moved to Maui in 1973, I met all of these people there, and we all felt like we recognized each other from another time, you know. And it's, you know, everybody wants to think it's reincarnation or something along those lines, but it was very interesting how, you know, you'd meet somebody and you go, gee, I feel like I've met you before.
That happened to me a few times in my life, and I got to say, can I share with you what I've experienced?
Sure.
Okay, I myself believed that I had a contract to come down to Earth prior with God, and he told me it was going to be a tough time, but he didn't tell me it was going to be this tough. Before I came here to Earth, I felt like he was warning me with the choice whether I could come here or not, and I'm happy I did, even though it is a tough time.
That's very interesting.
I mean, just to give you an idea of how much of a tough time, I mean, when I was 3 years old, I had a speech impediment. I had asthma, allergies. I went to school. And then at nighttime, I went to the speech and hearing center. Then at the evening time, it was the emergency room. So,
oh, gosh.
Yeah,
wow.
Just tough in that way. But to move on, what I'm trying to say is sometimes I feel like we met people in the spirit world prior. And that's why I feel that we have such a connection with some people. And you have a good one. You have a good reply as well.
Yeah, you know, it, just meeting people that you felt like you knew them. And an interesting thing, when I met one of the kahunas on the islands in Hawaii, Sam Lono, he said, "You were here before on the Lost Continent of Mu." He didn't call it the Lost Continent. He just called it Mu or Lemuria. And it gave me goosebumps.
Yes.
Is the only thing I can say.
It's kind of like our spirit is within a different time zone as our body. For me, it is, at least, right?
Right. Yeah.
Now, have you tell us, first of all, where people could catch your website. Let's tell them a little bit about you.
Okay, you can go to my website at merlefankhauser.com, and it's MerlefankHauser. And there's a bio there and a picture gallery, and also a catalog of all of my releases of albums and CDs and DVDs.
And they can get these DVDs and albums, I mean, all over the place, right?
Yeah, they're, you know, distributed in stores. But if they want to get them directly from me and have me sign them, they can do that by going to the website.
I think that'd be better. I think that's kind of cool that you sign it and get personally involved with your fans. That's nice to know.
Yeah, I have a book out that's called Calling from a Star, the Merle Fankhauser story, and it's available on Amazon, and it's sold quite well there. But I even have people that buy the book from Amazon, Richard, and then they send it to me to have me sign it, because they didn't know they could get it directly from me, and I would sign it. And every time I do one of these shows, I sell quite a few of the books.
Well, fantastic. Let's give your website one more time, then, and we'll do it again. But
okay, it's merlefankhauser.com, MerlefankHauser.com.
Well, thank you, Merle, and for being here. Especially, well, let's begin with what inspired you to write this book?
Well, after many years of playing music from 1962 on, you know, I started in 1962 and did an album with my band, The Impacts, that came out on Delphi Records, and now, oh gosh, not counting the compilation albums, I have over 40 solo albums. And people kept bugging me, "Oh, you need to write a book. You've had so many experiences." So in 1991, I started on it. But it took me years because of, you know, playing live and then doing a TV show that I was doing in 91 called California Music that was on satellite. And I'd write a little, you know, and then go back to it. And it took me over 10 years to write the book, actually. And then more things would keep happening, and I'd go, "Oh, I got to put that in."
Well, congratulations on that to begin with. That's not easy, especially how did you deal with the fame that you had and writing this book? How did you balance your life with everything?
Well, when I decided to write the book, there were dates and things, Richard, that I couldn't remember. And luckily, my mother was still alive then. And I would visit her, and she'd say, "Go in the hall closet, and there's a box up there." And bless her heart, she kept all of these magazine and newspaper articles going way back, so I could you know, find a date for these various things. And then she'd remember certain concerts that we played somewhere, you know, up in the desert, in the high desert of Antelope Valley or L.A. or wherever it was. And that really helped a lot. And as I was writing it, then, you know, I would have to go out of town for a week or so and come back and try to put myself back into that frame of mind where I left off. And I understood then why they say writers go off into a cabin somewhere in the woods,
yeah,
you know,
with
no distractions, so you can completely immerse yourself in it. And that's why, you know, I had to keep writing and rewriting, because I would get some stories in the wrong years. And I kept doing it and then proofreading it over and over again. Then I had an English major come in and check all of the grammar, punctuation, and then write more. And I finished it and got a publisher that I had two publishers actually that wanted to put it out, and got it out, and it's been a pretty good seller for quite a few years now. It came out in 2014, I think.
about 5 years ago.
Yeah, not quite.
Not quite. Well, it's I'm glad it's selling. It's very well. That's one reason why you got called on a lot of radio stations besides your songs, right?
Yeah. People that knew about the book and read the book, and then they start seeing all these adventures I went on. I was living in a suburb of Los Angeles in 1968 called Woodland Hills, and in a rented house, I was cleaning up the log bin around the fireplace. This was in 1969, and I found this book called The Lost Continent of Mu by Colonel James Churchward. And I was just enthralled with it and couldn't put it down. And he talked about these discoveries in South America and in the Hawaiian culture that all told that the Hawaiian Islands were now the mountain peaks of the lost continent of Mu, or Lemuria, that was once out of water. And it's in South American and North American Indian legend. And I felt, I have to say, a kinship with this right away.
Yes.
And I started getting all of these songs that were coming to me while I was reading this book about the lost continent of Mu. And the band I was playing with at the time, we didn't have a name for the band, and we were just doing these concerts, and even the agents were saying, well, you got to have some kind of a name, you know, it can't be just Merle and the Boys. And so we all just got this flash to call the band Mu. And we did that, and some producers heard us playing actually at the Beverly Hilton Grand Ballroom and signed us and went in the studio and produced our first album. And it came out on Era Records from Beverly Hills, and immediately started getting a lot of FM radio play and selling well. And then United Artists picked it up, and it came out in England. So we were off to a good start with that band. And then we made some money, and in 1973, we felt it was our destiny to move to the island of Maui. And the record company and our agent, promoters, and everybody said, what? You're going to move to an island in the middle of the South Pacific, and we were doing big TV shows in Los Angeles and a lot of radio interviews.
Oh, boy. And, a change.
Yeah. And so they weren't all that happy when we packed up and loaded up our guitars and amplifiers and our clothes and flew to Hawaii and rented a house in Haiku, which is on the edge of the rainforest. And I started going off in the jungle immediately searching for ruins.
Well, before we go on, I was just going to say you were very compelled to go here because you were driven there. It's not so much you had something very successful going on here, and then you're driven to go to Hawaii.
Yeah. Yeah, and the band felt the same way. It's amazing, you know. They didn't say, well, hey, let's stay here and milk all of this publicity for as much money as we can get out of it. And we were making a good living, had a house with a swimming pool, two roadies, and, you know, a large equipment vehicle, and things were going good. And we just said, nope, we're moving to Maui.
Now, everybody was against this, like you said, your producers. And so did you have to stop doing what you were doing, or you just went to Hawaii and worked from there? Or what is the story in that case?
Well, we kept doing the concerts. And I remember the last concert we did was with Country Joe McDonald from Country Joe and the Fish. And it was at El Camino College in Torrance. And that was a big concert, and the producers figured out, they got us in the studio to record some other songs for a future album and some singles that they could get put out. So, you know, all of our promo that we built up wouldn't just go away. So we moved to Maui and started playing gigs there, and we did a big concert in Lahaina that was advertised on all the islands, and it was sold out, and we had a lot of radio play on our music going on there. So we didn't really stop playing. We kept playing, and we met an engineer who had recorded an album for Quicksilver Messenger Service in Hawaii. And it was called Just for Love. And he happened to have a lot of leftover recording equipment from Capitol Records. And he loved us. So he came into our house, and it had a big glassed-in porch that looked through a glass window into the living room. And he goes, you know, this would make a perfect recording studio. I could set up all my equipment here on this enclosed porch and see you through the window. All we have to do is drill a hole in the wall for the cables to go through. And that's what he did. And over about a three-month period, we recorded all these new songs that mostly that I had written. And they took on a more of a spiritual feeling, Richard. The music we were doing in Los Angeles was more, it was different. It had elements of blues and jazz and rock in it. But when we got to Maui, boy, it was like some magical inspiration washed over us.
You talk about synchronicity in this occurrence, and you talk about everybody wanting to go. It was just pulling you in this direction. There was no questions. You were meant to be there.
Yes, and that's what, getting back to what we said at the beginning, that's what was so interesting. We would meet all of these people that had similar feelings and felt like we knew each other from somewhere. And there were a lot of people that were there from Hawaii, but people, we found a lot of people from California and Oregon and Washington, and some people from as far away as Michigan had felt this calling to go to that particular island of Maui. And then I started meeting all of these Hawaiian people and older Hawaiians,
right,
that felt a kinship with me, and I told them about my search to find remnants of the lost continent of Mu. And it was amazing. They started telling me where to go look for some of these things that were on the island.
Amazing. I mean, this island, how long was it underwater before they found it again?
Well, they say that the continent sank 11,500 years ago. And this older Hawaiian man that lived further out in the jungle, actually on the road to Hana, he showed me a trail that went down into this valley, and there was a stone-cut stairway going down, and it was, you know, through trees. And he said, I used to play down there when I was a little kid, but my parents forbid it. They said it was kapu, forbidden, and that they said, you better not go down there. The Mu people might get you and take you away. And that's what he said to me, and I went, wow.
Yeah.
So he took me to the edge of this trail, and he didn't want to go down there, and he said, go ahead. And so I went down, and I came to this pristine waterfall.
You were by yourself at the time, right?
By myself,
okay,
yeah.
Okay.
I explored many of these things off in the jungle by myself, and the Hawaiians wouldn't even believe that I would do it. And one of the old kahunas told me, you have an amakua watching over you. That's like a protector.
Yes, yes.
And they were all amazed that I wasn't afraid to go do this. So I look back at some of the things I did now, and I think, wow, that was pretty chancy, you know. So anyhow, I get down to this waterfall, and there's this stone platform that looked very much like Mayan or Inca stonework, where they're blocks that are cut like they're cut on a milling machine and put together. And there were these three pillars standing in a semicircle, and they almost looked Grecian in a way, because the sides had these knurled, is the only way I can say, lines, you know, on them. And one of them was halfway broken off and laying in the water. And I'd have to say they were probably 30 feet, 25 feet, somewhere around there, tall. Then I noticed there was the same kind of stonework, a sidewalk going under the hal bush towards the ocean. So I crawled on my hands and knees under this bush, and I could see where it went off under the water. And I could see out under the water probably 50 feet out, and there was the lava flow going over the sidewalk.
Oh,
and
man,
that lava flow was at least 1,000 years old. So I knew all of this stonework was older than that. And then years later, some geologists went down there, and they carbon dated the pillars and the stonework, and they said they were over 10,000 years old. And those, there's a picture of one of the pillars, a side view, where I could get some light, because it was kind of dark down there with all of this growth. And I got a picture of the side of one of these pillars, and that's in my book.
Quite a journey there. I mean, especially being by yourself and investigating this, but you knew you had the protection. I remember one time I took my camera out to the Bronx, never been there, and I was on the subway, and people were getting robbed that day on the subway when I was taking pictures. Again, just like you're saying, I think there's, in my case, a lot of angels that watch over me, just like you have your protection. It's interesting how we're protected in the spirit world.
Yeah, this is true. And that was my first discovery. And then my band and I were hiking through Haleakala Crater on Maui at 10,500 feet. And we were on the trail. And there's signs posted not to leave the trail. And this was probably 2 or so in the afternoon. And I looked out into this ancient dried lava field and saw what looked like a pyramid. And the rest of the guys saw it too. The band was with me. And I said, my God, look at that. And I had my little camera again then, and I said, I've got to get a picture of that. Well, it looked like it was, you know, just across the street or something. But you couldn't judge distance there or how tall what I was looking at actually was. So I started hiking towards this thing, and I had to jump these chasms that I would look down and I couldn't see the bottom. It was like a crack in the dried lava.
Oh, man.
And I jumped 2 or 3 of those, and the last one I kind of slipped a little bit, and the dried lava, because it's so sharp, cut my jeans. And I got to this pyramid, and it was, in fact, a three-sided, smooth-sided pyramid. And I tried to climb up the side of it, which was a big mistake.
Yeah.
And I got vertigo and got very dizzy. So I got down, and I estimated it to be maybe 48 feet tall. And so I got to a vantage point with the sky in the back, because if you looked at it from a certain angle, Richard, it was weird. It would blend into the rest of that lava field, and you couldn't see it. You had to be in a certain angle where it was sticking up out of it, and you had some, you know, sky or something clear in back. So I took a picture of it. I actually took a couple. And got one that came out good and made it back to the trail. And that, when I went in town and got it developed, you know, no digital cameras back then.
No, not back then.
I was just so happy and elated that I had these pictures. And it didn't end there. On the desolate side of the island, where the road ends, you go past Kihei and McKenna Beach. There's just a gravel place where people park, and Hawaiian fishermen go there and fish at this beach. And there's, you hike over this little lava flow ridge, and there's like a stone, It's big enough you could drive a Jeep on it if you could get it out there, but you couldn't. There's a stone roadway that goes through the lava field with stone walls on the side, and then you'll come to a hill of lava as big as a house, and you got to climb over that, and then you'll see the road continues on. Well, to the left mountainside, you have the ocean on the right. I started noticing all of these doorways and more of this stonework.
Right.
And it was an intermix of the Hawaiian stuff, but underneath you could see this other cut stone work. And the cut stone work was so much different than the Hawaiian stuff, because they just basically take boulders and lava rock and stack it up, you know, and then put a thatched roof on it. So I heard from a friend of mine that had hiked out several miles, and he said, you'll see a red cinder cone up towards the mountain, and there's a large building that's almost as big as a thrifty drugstore there.
Okay.
So I hiked and hiked, and it was very hot there because there's no foliage. There's no water, you know. It's just this hot lava with those waves of heat radiating off of it. And so I got to this big building and found it. It was a Hawaiian building. It had octopus lures. I knew what they were, embedded in the rock wall.
Okay, wait. I'm sorry to back up. What is an octopus lure? What do you mean by that?
Lure.
Lure.
They make it out of a stone and shape it a certain way.
Okay.
And I guess when you put it in the water, it attracts the octopus, and then you can catch it. So in the corner of this big building, there was a hole in the floor. And there's this rickety ladder. I don't know how they got the wood out there to build it. And it was kind of crazy to test this ladder because I didn't know how long it had been since somebody went down into this cellar, I would have to call it.
At least a couple hundred years, or what would you say?
No. Hippies and adventurers me and other people, maybe a few years before or something had gone down there. But it's interesting, the Hawaiians won't go out there. They're afraid of this place. They'll go out and fish at this beach, but before it gets dark, they leave because they say they hear strange voices and sounds like babies crying.
And what does that mean? Does that mean anything, or they're just hearing spirits, or what is it that they're hearing?
Well, I don't know. It could be, but I do know that the wind whistling through these odd Salvador Dali-looking natural lava forms, it can make some eerie sounds.
Okay.
So I go down in this cellar, and I had a little flashlight, and I was amazed again, Richard. There was this same stone-cut floor and walls and even the ceiling that I had seen on the complete other side of the island in the rainforest. And it was pretty amazing. And then I realized I needed to get out of there before it got dark. All day trip, you know. I started in the morning. So I started hiking back out of there, and boy, I was getting pretty hot, you know. I was in my late 20s. I think I was about 28 when I was doing this, and I was in good shape. And I made it back to the pickup truck, and I was really glad. And I told this story on Coast to Coast a few years ago, and a couple happened to be vacationing on Maui and heard me on Maui.
Right.
And they emailed me and said they wanted to go out there, that the guy was interested in archaeological stuff. And I said, well, you better have good hiking boots and take lots of water and something to eat. And, you know, make sure you don't go too far. Well, he went out there, and his wife got heat exhaustion.
Oh.
And he had to practically carry her back to the car. And they only went half as far as I did, but they saw all of these buildings under this lava flow that was, I think, quite a bit over 1,000 years old. And he said he couldn't believe it, that it was all there, just like I said. And I took pictures of those and put them in my book. But the only problem was, by the time I had reached that building with the seller, I was out of film.
Oh, so no.
I didn't get that, but I got all the ruins going to it. And this fellow that emailed me, he got some of the pictures also. So those are all in my book that people can see. And when I did this on Coast to Coast and then another radio show that was heard in Hawaii, this was, 5 or 6 years ago, I did another show that wasn't Coast to Coast, but they heard it. I was getting all these young people, Hawaiians, emailing me going, "We've never heard of this. Our parents and our grandparents have never told us about this." And they just couldn't believe it. Well, there is a book called Children of the Rainbow that was written by a Hawaiian.
Right.
And it talks about the people that were living in the Hawaiian Islands when the Hawaiians came there from Tahiti. And they said on that part of the island, there was a white, blonde, and red-haired race living there. And they called it the King's Burial Ground. And that road that I was talking about that's half covered was called the King's Highway. And I was over on Oahu in the Bishop Museum, and to my amazement, I looked in this glass case, and there was a stone axe head that was found in that very area, and it said, possibly this is of Viking origin.
Oh, that would be a few, what year would that be in that case then?
You mean when they were there?
Yeah.
I don't know. I have no idea. Either they were there later in this race that the Hawaiians saw, could have been people from Mu living there, or it could have been some, you know, Viking settlement. I know the Vikings went everywhere, but it seems to me like that would be too early for the Vikings to have gone there. So this has been, you know, I've written many songs about this, and I wrote an album that came out in 2000 and again in 2014 called Return to Mu, that was produced by my good friend William E. McEwen, who did movies for Steve Martin and albums for the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band and the Allman Brothers, and he produced this album on me, Return to Mu, and he even went over there with me and took all of his great cameras, and we went to the edge of the ruins. We went into a little of the ruins, and he took some pictures of me, and we were in this one odd-looking rock formation that had trees around it before you got into the lava flow, and I was sitting there, and he's taking these pictures of me, and I got this weird, chilling feeling up my spine, Richard, like somebody else was there watching.
Like a spirit, right? I feel like,
yeah. And I didn't see anybody, and we're way out in the middle of nowhere, and me and him and one other person that was helping with the cameras was all that was there. So we took a little break, and I walked around in back of this kind of hill of rocks, and I saw these stairs leading up. I walked up to the top of the stairs, and then when I got a better look at it, the whole mountain of what I was sitting in front of looked very pyramid-shaped. And there was a fire pit at the top of this hill, and I could tell people had been up there in recent times, you know, and and had started fires and, you know, maybe cooked
right.
something or even camped there. And I don't think it would be the Hawaiians because, again, you know.
They don't believe in it. Yeah, it's not.
It was taboo to them. They thought there were some spirits there that might get them or something.
So he went
back to Honolulu. He had one of these Hasselblad cameras, if you
right.
know what that is.
2 1/4, I sure do, yeah.
Yeah, very expensive still camera, wide angle. He went to this special lab on Oahu to get the film developed. And when he got the film developed and had slides made, we were all looking at it through a loop. And all of a sudden, one of these pictures where I'm sitting there, there's an Asian-looking woman over my left shoulder, almost like she's suspended, you know, in front of these rocks under these trees. And she had like a purple top and these ancient-looking leather sandals that laced up her leg. And William, I call him Bill, he went, "What the heck is this?" And you really have to prove stuff to him, you know. He's like, "Okay, prove it to me." So he went back to the lab, to this very articulate Japanese photography tech, and said, "How did that get on my picture?"
Yeah.
He said, "What did you do? Did you develop somebody else's picture over mine?" And the guy says, "No, that's on your negative. Look at your negative. We didn't do anything." He said, "That was there." And to this day, Bill is still dumbfounded how this happened. And I kept telling him, "I had this feeling there was somebody watching us in back of me." You know, and
that's what it was. You felt the spirits, and that's what I was going to say. When you, what else did you feel? I know there were many spirits that you must have felt around there.
Well, I was sitting there sort of meditating when that happened, and the next picture that he took, the lady wasn't in it anymore, but I had levitated out of my body. And you could see part of me down on the bottom, and part of me was projected up, like I was astral projecting.
Or you think it was a out-of-body experience as well, both, right?
It could be, yes. And he saw that, and he went, "What the heck? I got to have this camera checked out." And so we finished the Return to Mu album,
okay,
and it came out first in 2000 on CD, then a German label picked it up and put it out on LP, and then the great label in New York, Sundays, that puts out a lot of really interesting stuff, re-released it in about, oh gosh, I guess that was 2011. And it's kept selling, and then a Japanese label even released it. Well, we had some songs that were left over from the session that wouldn't fit on the one CD.
Right.
And we did some more, and we got an album out, and Bill said, "Well, let's call it The Man from Mu." And we used that picture where it looks like I'm astral projecting out of my body, and you can still find that LP on the internet for sale, and it's called The Man from Mu by Merle Fankhauser, and the picture is beautiful because, you know, it's not down to a small CD size, it's a big LP size.
Yeah, nice and crisp, exactly, yes.
Yeah, so these things, you know, I'm still, every little thing about Mu that I find, I read, and I have the Hawaiian book, Children of the Rainbow, by Leonani Melville, and all of the churchward books, The Lost Continent of Mu, and his great I think it's his great-grandson, Jack Churchward, heard my albums, and I think he lives in Florida.
Right.
And he's emailed me several times and even sent me a signed book that he made explaining all of these things that Colonel James Churchward discovered and explaining the hieroglyphs that are down in the Yucatan that talked about the lost continent. And so that's neat that I've struck up a friendship with him. And, you know, I'm still, every time I find something about this, I'm amazed. There's another clue.
Yeah, exactly. Pieces of the puzzle being put together. Sometimes the spirit doesn't give us the puzzle all at once. It comes in little fragments, right?
Yeah, that's right. And you go, aha, that's what that means.
And then you're frustrated for 5 years trying to figure out, well, what did that mean? You know.
Yeah. But the songs keep coming, Richard, and it's like I'm blessed that I don't have to struggle to write songs. And I once had a meeting in 1978 when I was still living on Maui, and I was over in L.A. recording, and I had a friend named Harry Nilsson. You might know who he is. Very fantastic songwriter and singer. And we were friends back in the 60s when we wrote for a little publishing company. And he said, oh, I'm having a party at my house. Why don't you come over? And so they sent a car and picked me up and took me up there. And I'd only been in California for 2 days from Maui. And I brought my acoustic Martin guitar with me. And I walked in. There was 20 or so people there. And I looked across the room, and there was John Lennon sitting there.
Oh, now, okay. Now, what was he like?
And I went, oh, boy. And Harry goes, this is my friend Merle from Maui, and he's going to play a song for us. And I went, oh, great, Harry. So I opened up the case, and I have never gotten stage fright in my entire life.
Right.
My lips started twitching, and I'd never had that happen. And I went, okay, Merle, pull it together. So I played my song, On Her Way to Hana, which is about seeing two silver saucers while driving the beautiful winding road to the little village of Hana. And there's a video of that on YouTube. And so I played the song, and right away John started talking. He said, that was really great. He said, what inspired that? And so I told him. And then everybody was going over to the bar and the food, and I actually got to talk to him for about 15 minutes without any other people around. We went to this little alcove, and he said, isn't songwriting odd? He said, I didn't write any of those songs in the Beatles. And I went, what? And he said, yeah, they were just given to me. It was a gift. And he said, and you never know when or where a song is going to come through, and you better be prepared and have some little tape recorder or a way to write it down, because if you hear some other music or somebody starts talking to you, it'll go away. And I said, that's exactly right. And I said, my best songs are written in 15 minutes, and you hear it finished in your head, and then you got to go figure out how to play it on a guitar or a piano.
Yeah.
And he said, right on, same thing. And he said, that's automatic writing, mate. That's what he called it, automatic writing.
So he was no stranger to channeling songs then?
No, he wasn't. And then I had producers telling me, you know, some that were into that, saying, "Oh, you this is another song you channeled," you know. So, you know, and they want to say that now, you know, the popular thing, and there's a lot of books out like Alien Rock, The Extraterrestrial Connection by Michael Luckman. They want to say, "Oh, it's the ETs and UFOs that are you're being channeled by." And I've been inspired by, you know, one UFO sighting that I had on Maui once, but I can't say all of those songs are coming from ETs or UFOs. It could be coming from God.
Exactly.
Or John.
Yes.
John claimed he had a muse that was giving them to him, you know.
What's a muse? I'm sorry, what is a muse?
It's your inspirational angel, if you will.
Okay, okay, I got it.
That just beams it down to you. And so, you know, that conversation I had with John has stuck with me till all this time to today. And I still think about it once in a while, you know, and especially when I'll get an idea for a song. And, you know, this feeling comes over you and you know something's going to come out. And when I wrote one of my most favorite songs called Waterfall, when I lived in my cabin in the jungle on Maui, I had a stream going in front of the house mm-hmm. with a deck, and a little ways away was a waterfall. And I would sit there and meditate and pull out my guitar and a song would come out. And I had one of those little Radio Shack tape recorders, the little long things,
yep.
you know, that
mm-hmm.
they made back then that would run on batteries. And that would save me so I could remember. Well, I was asleep in bed, and I woke up, and the sound of the water going over the rocks in front of the stream inspired this guitar part I heard in my head. It was a cascading downward chord progression. Da 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 da. And I picked up the guitar and started playing it and started singing this song that sounded like it came from heaven. And Mary, my violinist girlfriend, woke up and she went, "What is that?" And I said, "I don't know. I'm writing it." And we tried to turn on the tape recorder and the batteries were dead.
Oh, no.
So she turned on a kerosene lantern and grabbed a paper bag because she could write music and started writing
fantastic.
The notes,
okay.
The notation and the words down. But in the dark, I couldn't tell what chords they were. My fingers were just automatically going somewhere.
Yeah.
But so I stayed up all night playing this song over and over again, afraid I would forget it and forget that freshness. And I knew a friend in town that was about, 12 miles in town, towards town.
Right.
That got up early in the morning to go surfing, and he had a reel-to-reel tape recorder in his living room. So I drove right in there at daybreak, and I said, "Sammy, I got a song. Can I use your tape recorder?" And he said, "Yeah, I just put a fresh reel of tape on it." So I went in and sang the song into this tape recorder, and I was so happy that I got it down. And I ended up actually taping that waterfall on that little cassette recorder. And when we went to L.A. in 1975, we recorded the Maui album. And Dino Arali, who was running Dark Horse Records for George Harrison at the time, recorded the first 10 songs for us and played them for George. And George really, really liked them. In fact, he took a tape back to England with him on a trip. And Dino showed him all these pictures of my house and the waterfall on Maui, and he had never been there before. So we finished the album. It came out in 1976, and it's been reissued on foreign labels, label in Spain, quite a few labels, and even in Sweden on CD. And it got great reviews, and it's a lot of people write me and say, well, that album and your Return to Mu album are my favorite albums. Well, go forward about a year and a half to 1977, and George Harrison buys some land further out in the jungle for me, and he writes a song called My Sweet Hana.
Yeah.
That was very similar to On Our Way to Hana in some of the music.
So what did you do in that case?
Nothing. Okay. Mary Lee, the violinist, said, okay, now you've been ripped off by a beetle.
Oh, great.
So I didn't think anything of it, but I did see George's young son, Danny, and his wife, Olivia, once in town at a restaurant, and they knew who I was and said hi, and, you know, that was that story.
That was the extent of it, huh? Ugh.
Yeah.
Man.
So I'm just thankful, Richard, that today I'm still making music and labels all over the world still want to put it out. And I think I told you I'm on this new album called Eclectia that was produced by a radio host in London, Joanna Summerscales.
Mm-hmm.
And it's 17 bands from U.S., Canada, and the U.K. that all believe their songs are inspired by ETs or UFOs. Well, they decided they wanted my Calling from a Star song that I recorded in 1978 that came out then on a vinyl 45, and now it's on several albums and CDs. And they put that song, Calling from a Star, as the first song on the first disc on Eclectia. And it's on, close to 100 stations now globally, and it just came out a little over a month ago. So it's just getting out there and getting distributed. Now, and the album cover is interesting. It's a parody of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band album cover.
Okay, but so you use some of their stuff, so that's good.
Well, I didn't do it. The artist for the
artist.
Label in England did it. And down where the Beatles were standing on their album cover, he put three gray aliens.
Okay.
So it's got a whole bunch of different musicians that are on it, and then a lot of well-known ufologists and UFO researchers like Stanton Friedman and Grant Cameron, and there's a lot of people on it. And I'm up in the left upper corner just below Neil Young and a little above what's her name? Linda Moulton Howe. You know who she is?
No, but I know who Neil Young is.
Yeah. And then David Bowie is down a little lower
of course.
Than me. So it's an interesting release, and there's interviews on it, short 2-minute sound bites of people saying how they were inspired by a UFO that they saw or something before their song. And I don't think anybody's ever done anything like this before, and we'll just see how it goes from here. But I've been doing a lot of radio interviews about this release, Eclectia, And so far it's available digitally on a lot of different online sites. And they can also get it on CD from me by contacting me.
Okay, and what's your email?
Yeah, my email is merle@merlefankhauser.com. And you spell my first name M-E-R-R-E-L-L, last name F-A-N-K-H-A-U-S-E-R. So I'm a mix of Swiss, Fankhauser is Swiss, German, my mother was German, and my grandmother was Wyandotte Indian.
All good. It's all good. You have a lot of fire in you, and that's great.
It works.
Thank you.
No. I often thought that that's why I had this rapport with the Hawaiians, something to do with the native aspect.
Very much so, yeah. There's a connection there for you. And thank you, Merle. Why don't you give your website one more time?
Okay, the website is merlefankhauser.com. And there's a whole bio there, pictures, and a catalog.
Thank you so much for being here tonight. I really, really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Richard, for having me on your show.
Are you intrigued by Paranormal Talk Radio? You'll love the new Paranormal Radio app from TalkStream Live. You'll find a great selection of talk shows covering UFOs, ghosts, strange phenomena, and much more. Download the Paranormal Radio app now and start listening to the very best in paranormal talk entertainment. The Paranormal Radio app, free in Google Play and the iOS App Store.
Welcome to the Richard Spassoff Show. Tonight's guest is Tina Mahina, and I'm happy to have her here. Hi, Tina.
Aloha, Richard.
Aloha. Hey, that means in Hawaiian, what does that mean? Hello and goodbye? Or?
It does. Well, in Hawaii, they like to say hello and farewell.
Farewell. Well, okay. I'll say goodbye, and I hope our recording was good. No, just kidding. No, we have a lot to talk about tonight, and I don't know what direction we're going to go in, except you have a lot of stories to share with us. Would you like to start?
Yes, and first I'd like to thank you for having me on the show.
You're very welcome.
I would like to kind of start in the middle, if I may.
Yeah.
And I live in beautiful Branson, Missouri, which is in the heart of the Ozark Mountains in southwest Missouri. And I moved here almost 33 years ago. I came here on vacation, took one look at the beautiful mountains. It was an entertainment community, which I'm also an entertainer. But the spirit here, the energy here was just fascinating. So I stayed. I didn't even go back to Tulsa, Oklahoma to get my things. I called my friends who had a key to my apartment and said, keep it, sell it, or give it away. I am not coming back home. I'm staying in the Ozark Mountains. And I'm so glad that I did, because it has led to some amazing experiences, some with paranormal activity, in fact.
Which we're going to talk about. But before we do, you're in the entertainment field, and your husband is Barry Williams, correct?
He is.
And you guys have a lot of, I mean, not only are you guys, tell us a little bit about what you do before we start talking about the experience.
Well, Right now, living in Branson, we don't have a show here in Branson.
Okay.
Like, you know, the 76th Strip is full of theaters. Andy Williams was here before he passed away. Jimmy Osmond now has taken over that theater. There's the Haygood family, the Hughes family, all kinds of variety shows and tribute shows. And Barry did have a show in Branson here for several years, but we're no longer doing that. We're picking and choosing right now. He's got some great projects going on, one with HGTV, a very Brady renovation.
Great, because that's going to bring a lot of happiness to a lot of people.
Absolutely. And, you know, the Brady Bunch is in their 50th anniversary year this year in 2019.
Well, congratulations on that to begin with for the whole
thing. Yeah.
Now,
I think it's great for...
Yeah, very, very, very much. What? How does Barry feel about this? I mean, does everybody have feelings for each other, or is it more of a business arrangement?
You know, they've all stayed in touch through the years and celebrated, you know, all the milestones of their lives. Christopher Knight came to our wedding with his lovely wife. And so I think it's just been very heartening that a group of people, when they're young, can stay, even if you're miles away and you have other things going on in your life, you know, you touch base and check in and out with one another. It's been wonderful, and they've been all so loving and kind to me.
I'm glad to hear that, because you don't know. When you see the show, it's acting, of course, but in real life, I felt like they had a connection, a very close connection, and I guess that's correct. So that's good to know.
Absolutely. And Barry's also the ambassador for MeTV, which is Classic Television, and we are so thrilled that Classic Television is just gangbusters now. And MeTV is at the forefront of all of that. And we are so happy to be a part of that team.
I'm so excited for you guys, and I'm sure a lot of people around the world. I mean, where do you guys get the most, when people watch the Brady Bunch, is it mostly in the U.S.? Is it in Europe? Where is it all the same everywhere around the world, or? What would you say?
Tell you, in the U.S., it's great because TV has, you know, the Brady Bunch on Sundays. But I tell you what, Australia just loves the Brady Bunch. And I can't wait to get down there and meet the Brady Bunch fans. I've not been to Australia yet. Of course, Barry has. And we are so excited to have an opportunity in the future to go back and meet some of our fans, new fans, old fans of the Brady Bunch, you know, because it passes down to the generations. So grandma and grandpa may have watched it, then mom and dad, now the grandkids and great-grandkids. It's awesome how it's just going through all the generations, because it's nostalgic. And, you know, there was a lesson or a moral or a value to learn in each episode, which is so good, and people don't get enough of that these days.
Very much so, yes. It brings that warmth. It's a wholesome soul that is projected, and that's nice to know. It's a fun
Absolutely.
Show. Yeah, yeah. I was talking to Stanley Livingston a while back, and their show was the same way, but instead... I did not know that Fred McMurray never, he wasn't on set too much. They film his part separately. Did they do that on the Brady Bunch at all, or were most of the people there all the time?
Well, you know, you had your core people there all the time, and you had your scenes, you know, and sometimes, like, it would be a scene about Greg or a scene about Marcia. But they were there all the time, and then they had guest stars that would appear, you know, and come on and off the show.
Yeah, and some great guest stars. Could you name a few?
Oh, boy, put me on the spot. I know there's something about a real famous baseball guy.
Well, remember the one with Vincent Price, the one in Hawaii.
Yes, yes.
What was...
I love the episodes. a hula dancer, so that kind of is my thing.
Yeah, those bring back good memories, and it seems like it's being passed on, like you said, by generation after generation. So it's growing, right? And the new generation is still taking it on.
Absolutely. We just love it.
Well, let's go ahead and go back to your story. As you were saying, you were in the middle of it. Sorry about that.
That's okay. And I just want to mention one other thing.
Okay, yeah, please, please.
Even though Barry doesn't have a show in Branson any longer, we have formed a trio called Barry Williams and the Travelers. And I'm on vocals and percussion, Polynesian percussion, I add some of that. Barry is on guitar and vocals, and then we have another lead guitar player and vocals. It's a nice little trio. We do all kinds of wonderful music from different genres. But, you know, of course, we all love the 70s music, so we kind of focus there. It's like going to a hoedown, a luau, a disco, and a rock concert all in one. If you want to keep up with what all Barry
right,
and I yes, are doing.
Yes, please. I was just going to ask.
You can go to BarryWilliamsOfficial.com, and I maintain the website and help keep everyone up to date on upcoming events and things that we're doing.
Well, and I'm so happy. I can't wait for that show to come out, and I'm sure a lot of people feel the same way. So that's great. Congratulations.
Thank you. And a very brave renovation on HGTV should air in September, which would coincide with the actual 50th anniversary date.
Fantastic. Look forward to that. And now people know so they could tune in. I'm happy to hear that.
Absolutely. So as far as my experience here in the Ozarks, one of my experiences, paranormal activity. Now, I have known ever since I was a child that I was sensitive, and I felt that it was a curse, didn't understand that it could be considered a gift, which that's what I would like people to know that may have some past experiences or experiencing something now. There's usually a reason that activity occurs, and if there's no one there to hear you or talk to you about it, or if you don't have any research, like, it's so much easier to do research now and reach out to people and find information than it was back in the 70s when I was a child going through it. So I didn't have all the information at the time, so therefore I thought it was a curse.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
People, and
go ahead.
There are people, like you said, out there that you can reach out to and talk to. And it's sad that in today's society that people have to feel it's a curse. But go ahead.
Yeah, and as I got older and I was learning, you know, how to manage this, I ended up finding out it was a gift. And I will start with, I had a paranormal tech group. That was our name, Paranormal Techs. And we went to the historic Owen Theater in downtown Branson, which is a fabulous place. If you're ever in Branson, you have to stop at the Owen Theater. It is the original theater in Branson. It was built by James Mason Owen, and they call him Jim Owen. That's not the same Jim Owens that's the musician.
Okay.
But he came here on vacation like I did and stayed. He ended up the mayor of Branson for several years. And this theater, he would show movies, and he would have live entertainment. And it was about the only thing in the 30s for some of the folks in the community to come and congregate and fellowship and have fun. Well, a few years ago, the paranormal techs went in there. Of course, you'd know, late at night when the world is quiet and the spirit activity can be more conducive to speaking to you, and mm-hmm. we have our equipment. And we're on the stage, and as we're asking, you know, telling them that it's okay to speak, or, you know, however they want to communicate with us, that's fine. Well, one of the spirits called out one of the guys on my crew by name.
Oh, no.
Adam. Yes. So, and we had that recorded. And so that was a very big moment. As we got into the evening.
Okay, wait. Now, this guy's name is being called. What was their faces like? What did they feel? What did you, were you shocked? What?
Yeah, of course, we were all like, whoa, they know his name. And it came through, you know, the devices that we're recording through. And Adam, he's an amazing sensitive. He, even more so than I, the spirits just always have gravitated to him, even when he was a young person. So, you know, it wasn't unfamiliar to him,
right.
But to have them call you out by name is, of course, a little shocking. And I've had that experience when I was a child, too,
mm-hmm.
Like if we have more into that. But as the evening evolved, there would be a little orneriness, like a jar full of bolts and nuts and screws knocked over and spilled onto the floor. And as we got into it, a man would identify himself as Frank. And as we're asking Frank questions, he would tell us that back in the day, there were a lot of breathing problems, a lot of sickness, you know, whether it was asthma or whether it was the flu, you know, because it's hard to get a lot of medical help.
Right.
In a rural community that's mountainous back in the 30s, there was hardly anything here. And so we kept drawing that out. Then I took a break for a while, and, of course, I didn't have my equipment with me, and I went into the bathroom, and I was in there by myself, and all of a sudden the stall door next to me slammed.
Oh, boy. Jeez. Get me out of there.
I hurried.
Yeah.
Yeah, the ladies' room and went back to my crew. But it was hard, a little hard for me to keep the paranormal text together because we had so much activity that it would freak the crew members out, even though they went into this willingly and, you know, with curiosity. And, you know, when you get evidence, sometimes you know, want to distance yourself from it. I always, now that I understand that it's a gift, want to find out what it is that they have to say. Frank, that was coming through at the Owen Theater on our devices, and I was sharing about the breathing problems. Come to find out, I did some research about Frank, and he was friends with Gene Wallace. Gene Wallace is called the Mountain Maid of Roaring River here in the Ozarks, and she was she looks like Granny Clampett.
Yeah, you were showing me that picture, man. The
yes.
image of that and the energy that I felt when you showed me that picture, spunky son of a gun.
Yes, and she and Frank were friends. Well, Gene Wallace, the Mountain Maid of Roaring River of the Ozarks, mm-hmm. was a seer, and people in the community, and it's just a little bit west of here, in the Cassville, Missouri area, people in the community back then would go to her and ask her to read their fortunes. And she was pretty accurate from what I'm told. And she was one time, she was asked, well, why haven't you ever been married? And she said, what kind of husband would want a woman, a wife, that is going to know what he's going to be doing before he does it? So I thought that's humor also. Also, north of Branson is a place called Bonnybrook, and the very famous Rose O'Neill, who invented the Cupid doll, she would also go to the Owen Theater, and these people all knew one another. Now, I don't know how often they got together, because back then, even by car, it was a while, you know, a ways to get to the Owen Theater. And most people just had a horse and buggy. But they all seemed to have known each other. And if they didn't know each other directly, knew each other indirectly.
Right.
So the Owen Theater is just full of all this history. And I encourage your listeners to look up these people. Jim Owen at the Owen Theater, Gene Wallace, the Mountain Maid of Roaring River, Rosie O'Neill, the Bonnie Brooke, you know, creator of the Cupid doll. They're fascinating stories individually.
Very
well,
I'm sorry. Yeah, when you sent me that and you watched the Beverly Hillbillies, you could tell how the characters came about in that. Yeah.
and that's a good point that you bring up, because in Branson, we have in between Branson and Shepherd of the Hills, which is an outdoor play, which is also another good thing to Google because it's a fascinating book. John Wayne was in the movie. Actually, John Wayne did come to the Owen Theater as well as some old stars, and because Jim Owen had a fishing guide tour, so people would come here and relax and do the fishing and the Owen Theater. Well, Ruth and Paul Henning is the creator of the Beverly Hillbillies, Green Acres, and Petticoat Junction, and they donated around 1,500 acres as a conservation area between Branson and Shepherd of the Hills Outdoor Theater. So it's just full of history, and you can go on hiking trails, and a hiking trail may be called, you know, Petticoat Junction, and another hiking trail may be called Green Acres. Quite fascinating and quite beautiful.
So you would say this is like a new Hollywood in itself with paranormal activity, kind of two in one.
Yeah, there are definite pockets of paranormal activity here. It's a very, you know, charged energy place. And the house that we did after the Owen Theater, we didn't get a lot of audio evidence, but when we walked into this house, the energy was very heavy and thick. And I know some paranormal teams that are out there listening will understand what I mean by that. And the next day, everyone on our team, we slept from anywhere from 12 to 16 hours. None of us could get up. We were just we felt like our bodies weighed a ton.
Yes, yes.
Each experienced it, even though after, you know, we left the home and packed up our stuff and went to our prospective homes, we called each other after we woke up, and each of us had experienced the same experience. It was incredible that we each felt so tired and slept for so long.
Do you think that was a process of being healed in some way? I feel that.
Yeah, I do. The reason why we were called Paranormal Techs is because we all worked at theaters on crews doing spotlight and stagehand stuff, being sets around. And we were very busy schedules, sometimes 2, 3, and 4 shows a day. So I would like to think that the spirits were giving us a break, forcing us to have some downtime because we all work so.
In a good way, they were watching over you guys.
Absolutely.
And we have a lot to say, but you were talking about when you were little and how a lot of spirits came to you. You want to explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, my parents moved into a home. They had bought a couple of acres and had built a home in West Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I moved there when I was 2. The first memory that I recall was there was an area of my mom's yard that had little tiny rocks. The grass wouldn't grow. And I was about 4 years old, and my mom came outside, and she's like, "Who are you talking to?" And I said, "I'm talking to the Indian." Well, you know, little children, people say, you know, they're pretending or they're, you know, playing with imaginary friends. But I think children especially are sensitive and connected to the spirit world, and spirits easily can talk to children because they're not bogged down with all of the no's and the this is why it can't occur and all of this. They're open.
In a sense, yeah, yes.
Yeah, and when as time passed, things would happen around the house, like the ceiling fans would go on and off by themselves or loud noises. One time my tricycle came up the hill by itself, lights turning on and off by themselves. And at the time I was growing up, I was terrified of such things.
Oh, you were scared. Okay, okay.
I was at the time. I didn't mind talking to my Indian friends, but when things move around by themselves or turn on and off by themselves or loud, obnoxious noise, that bothered me. Now, other members of my family, including my mom, would encounter these same things, but it wouldn't bother them. I didn't have anyone sitting me down and explaining to me about the spirit world. I'm not even sure if they understood it themselves. I just knew that they weren't scared, and I was terrified.
I've been through a lot.
My mom did get, you know, her attention up was she was sitting in a stool, and her back was towards the hallway, and she felt someone press down on her shoulder, and she turned around because she knew no one was supposed to be in the house, and she turned around, and no one was there. That, you know, she did say that that kind of got to her a little bit. But otherwise, she would feel like, this is annoying because it's keeping me from my nap. And I'm sitting there going, how can you sleep?
How could you sleep when somebody's walking around or floating things around? Yeah, I mean.
Right.
I was raised same type of way when I was little. I could see things around the house. I was very fortunate to be able to talk to God and be able to see him and to be able to... I had a lot of health issues when I was little. So with saying that, I only got scared one time when I had a visit from, I would say, like a demon, and it scared the heck out of me. It was more like a night terror. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And this thing came into my room. It had fangs on it. And I was about 5 or 6, and it had blood dripping down its fangs, and it was so real. Ever since then, it never came back. I think it was some type of warning sign. That's all I think at the time.
What kind of warning?
Well, when I look back at it, I could see I had a lot of breathing issues, and at the time, my parents smoked cigarettes. I didn't know it was bad, of course. My dad did, at least. And I just think it was a warning, like you're going to get very sick and close to death if you don't get help, if you don't take care of yourself. That type of warning.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you can look on back on that experience and take that from it. And that's part of the reason why I wanted to speak to you today, because I know many people out there that feel the same way, and they don't know that it can be a warning. A gift is actually a blessing, not a curse.
Yes, very much so. And you, I mean, you have a lot of wonderful, inspirational stories, like the one about your mother-in-law. Can you share that one?
I can. She passed away a couple of years ago, and she was in hospice. And what happened was Barry and I were scheduled to be in San Diego for a MeTV event, and the hospice doctor called him and said, well, you should come now, and because we feel like she's not going to be here much longer. So I stayed behind, and he went out 10 days ahead of me. And each day it seemed like, you know, the doctors and nurses, well, it could be today, you know, it could be tonight. And 10 days went by, and it's a Sunday now, and I'm trying to get some sleep to get ready to go meet my husband in San Diego the next morning, which would the next morning would be Monday.
Right.
But I can't sleep.
No.
And she came to me in an awakened vision. So I had not gone to sleep. I was fully awake. And I'm very clairaudient. I can be some of the other clairs at times, but I'm very clairaudient. And it's not something I can ask to happen to me. It just, it does when it does.
Exactly.
But
yes, yes.
The right side of my face gets very warm, and I hear them speak, and it's like in their normal tone of voice, but loudly, so that it gets my attention. Well, first I saw a hawk flying, and I saw one feather fall from the hawk, and then I heard my mother-in-law say, "I want my day to be on your day." She wanted to share her day on my day, and I instantly knew in my gut what that meant, because my birthday was going to be on Tuesday. And my mother-in-law loves significance of dates, and she had her own significant dates, you know, mm-hmm. anniversaries coinciding with, you know, a loved one's passing or whatever. And I wasn't going to tell my husband about it. I get on the plane on Monday. I get to San Diego, and we're at the hotel, and we have, you know, some big picture windows, and we're looking at the lovely sky, and all of a sudden he says, "You know, maybe my mom wants to pass on your birthday."
Aww.
And I thought, I wasn't going to tell you this, but now that you brought it up, and I told him about my vision that I had. And right after that, a hawk passed by our window.
Right.
The next day, Tuesday, was my birthday, but we had a MeTV appearance, and we were checking in periodically, you know, with the doctors
right.
and nurses, and everything seemed to be fine. But since he had an appearance, they had my cell phone number to call me, and so I could get word to him.
Right.
Should they need to. So, you know, about 5:15, 5:30, my phone rings, and hospice says, "You know, you better come soon." So we wrap it up with MeTV and drive to where she is staying in Carlsbad. And as soon as I get out of the car, there's the hawk again flying right by. And I was the last family member to be with her. So it's almost as if she was waiting for me. My husband grabbed one hand of hers, and I grabbed the other hand, and I told her that Barry is going to be well taken care of. You know, I have his back. We love each other. We have each other's back. But I said, "Mom, you already know all this." And she just released gently without any struggle. Her head was tilted back, mouth wide open, and she just gently released. And it was on my birthday, just like she had said she wanted to share her day with me on my day 2 days
right.
before.
Oh, wow. Wonderful. I mean, you were there to help her move on into the other world, right?
To transition, yes.
And I bet you isn't your first time. You have other stories like this?
Well, I have another story I would like to share that's it's pretty significant about realizing that it's a gift and not a curse.
Yes.
And it has to do with a museum, although I choose not to mention the museum.
Okay.
It was and still is a military veteran museum.
Okay.
And, you know, in Branson here, we honor our veterans every day of the year. It's very important, you know, God and country in Branson, Missouri. And Barry has also done USO tours in the past. So he wanted to take me to this museum, and of course, I go, there's a plaque when you first go into the museum that has names of men that had served in the Navy.
Okay.
And I take a picture of the plaque, and, you know, I'm looking at all the neat stuff in the museum, and I come to this one area where there's a bunk, and I stop dead in my tracks. And, you know, museums, there's people constantly going through lines, so there was people before us and people behind us, and but all of a sudden, the people just kind of stayed where they were and were looking at other things, and I had some space, and I felt that warm feeling on the right side of my head, and loudly I heard a series of numbers. I said, "Barry, give me a pen and paper." So he gave me a pen and paper, and I wrote down what I heard, you know, and he's very supportive of my gift and lovingly so, and I so appreciate.
Yes.
And I didn't know what these numbers meant, but I wrote them down because that's what I heard.
Okay.
And over a course of a year, I went back as I could because my curiosity had piqued, wondering what this information meant. And I had gone onto some websites and looked at the veterans that were on what they call Eternal Patrol when they pass in transition. It's called Eternal Patrol if you're a veteran in the Navy. And so some of the names weren't matching up on the plaque that I had taken a picture of. So I thought that was curious. So I went back to the museum again, and I heard, "Help me, help me, help me." This particular spirit said everything in threes. So I, over this course of the year, put together this list of the names that were either misspelled or the names that were left off the plaque, because I have a website that lists the names that should have been on
okay.
the plaque.
Okay.
I put this lengthy list together, and long story short, a year passes, and lo and behold, they're having a reunion at this museum. And I had reached out to one of the gentlemen that takes care of the website and explained that I discovered the plaque wasn't correct, and could we, you know, perhaps tell the museum so they could get it taken care of. And after a period of time, he said, "Well, why don't you come to our reunion? Those that are still alive and can make it, you know, due to no health problems, would love to have you and Barry." So we went, and there was a big easel that had a picture of the plaque that was blown up, but it was the picture of the one that I took a picture of it where the names were wrong. And this gentleman came up to me and he goes, "See that name right there?" And I said, "Yes." He goes, "That's my name and it's spelled wrong."
And who was that gentleman? Who?
I don't remember his name right now,
okay.
But
yeah, we don't want to go there. Okay.
Did serve in the military, of okay. course, and Navy, and the next day there was a tolling of the bells, and that's where they read, and they had said that they were going to redo the plaque, but they just didn't have time to get it done correctly before the reunion.
Okay.
But when they rang the tolling of the bells and read everyone's name off, the gentleman that had spoken to me and his name had been left off the plaque, when they read his name and they rang the bell, he said, "Thank you, thank you, thank you," once again in threes. And from the tips of my toes out through the top of my head, I just felt this sense of peace lift over me. The interesting fact about this man is that his job in the Navy was a radio man, so he understood frequency. I thought that was quite incredible.
So was he a spirit? Was he a,
yeah.
Oh, that's what I got a chill. Up my spine.
He had been on
Eternal
Patrol and he reached out to me.
Aww.
And I, at one point, at because I went to the museum a few times at one point before the reunion, I was like, why me? Why are you talking to me? Because you can hear, you can hear, you can hear.
You know, people always ask, you know, a lot of people say, oh, I wish I could see ghosts in, or not, in this case, we're talking about spirits, but they say, I wish I could see my family members, but they don't look for simple things. What would you say to that, Tina? How would you?
Well, you know, I had an experience that, you know, some of my family members may say that it's coincidence.
Yeah.
But after Mom passed away, you know, and I told you that I'm a professional hula dancer, and I have been since I was 8 years old. And I performed with the Laughing Kahunas in the 70s when supper clubs were real big and popular.
Mm-hmm.
But after my mom passed away and I was at my brother's, my sister-in-law and I were writing out thank you cards to everyone that had sent flowers and condolences. And my brother and sister-in-law had a little radio in their bathroom. And all of a sudden, the radio came on, and on the radio was My Little Polynesian Baby Over the Sea. And I knew that was my mom through, you know, telling me it's okay, you know.
Yeah, because so, one of her songs, right?
Yeah, and she called me her little Polynesian baby because I was old hula dancer, you know, and I still perform hula. And in fact, Barry Williams and the Travelers, we try to incorporate some Hawaiian songs so I can get some of the guys out of the audience to do tiny bubbles with me, which is always real fun for the audience.
Yeah, you get them involved, exactly. And before, I don't know if we have more time, if you want to talk a little bit more, or how are we doing with time?
I would like to say a couple more things.
Okay, good.
And that when I started having some issues with insomnia and headaches and anxiety, because I was feeling overwhelmed with other people's energy. This is what I'd like to say to your listeners.
Okay.
If you're having those feelings of being overwhelmed by other people's energy or energy of spirits or things that you don't understand, there are people that you can talk to. There are classes you can take. There are books you can read. What helped me understand all of this was an author by the name of Alberto Villaldo. His name is hard to say, Villaldo.
Okay.
He's with the Four Winds Society. You can find his information at fourwinds.com. And also Wendy DeRosa. I just finished a wonderful 16-week class with her. She's the founder of the School of Intuitive Studies. So you can find her at schoolofintuitivestudies.com. And also a gentleman named Don Jose Ruiz has some books out there. His father is Miguel Ruiz, that was the author of The Four Agreements. And these people, in their each in their own way, because each path is different, each journey is different, but they all have foundational advice on diet, on breathing, on meditation, on understanding your inner self, so that the outer world or the world that's unseen does not overwhelm you. And I know that there are people out there that feel like they're suffering and they don't have to. And even though this may not be your path with these people, reach out and find that path. But this is a good start. I would highly recommend people check them out. And I also have put together recently a Facebook page, and more importantly, a Facebook group called Luminous Warriors. We're the Light Warriors. And it's a loving and safe environment for people to come together to share in their spiritual growth, information, words of wisdom, and encouragement, not only on a personal level for personal growth, but on a collective level, meaning the whole world, the whole planet, for collective growth. And we're coming into a period, I believe, we're exiting what you call a masculine period, especially a wounded masculine period, which would have began around the conquistador era. And now we're entering a feminine time, a feminine energy. But we need to be careful not to enter into wounded feminine. We, as women, we do not need to make men pay for years of suffering. That's not the way to handle some of the issues that are happening in our culture right now. It's called divine feminine, the mothering, the love, the light, the blessings. That's what we need to be talking about and sharing and helping with one another across the globe,
yes,
personally and collectively.
Yeah, that goes back to shining God's love on everyone, shining the Holy Spirit. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And I know with all different races within this world, everybody, if we could just shine love with each other and shine it to each other, I think that's a good start.
Yes. And in order to do that, we need to start with loving ourselves and being gentle with ourselves, because until we get that right, it's hard to do it with the outside world.
It is.
And spirit world.
But explain, when you say loving yourself, explain a quick example of that.
Yeah, not in a narcissistic ego way, but people tend to put themselves last. And you need to take time for yourself. You need to breathe deep. You need to take those 5 minutes. Hopefully those 5 minutes to yourself can turn into 10 minutes, which can turn into 30 minutes. People put themselves last. And they put their health last. They put their spiritual integrity last. They just tend to, we're addicted to suffering, and that's because we're putting ourselves last, and we need to spend time working on ourselves, exercising, eating right, loving yourself, being gentle yourself. People talk badly to themselves. And, you know, I'm having to learn this. I'm not just preaching to everyone out there. I'm preaching to myself too. It's a constant, it's work. It's deep work, but it's good work, and it's work that will last.
Yes.
Once
you do that, then you could help out other people, so you could realign your spirit again with God and move forward.
Absolutely. And you've heard the saying, the sins of the father passed down. We don't have to take that on. We can stop that. It's a choice, and we have to choose to start with ourselves and then spread it into our neighborhood, our community, and hopefully it will become love across the globe rather than hate.
Very much so. Before we leave, Tina, I would like to get your website one more time so that people could hear it.
Which one? That they can keep up to date with Barry and I?
Yes, and yours as well, and all that stuff.
Well, to keep up with Barry and everything that we're doing there, go to BarryWilliamsOfficial.com. And if you're interested in my Facebook group, it's called Luminous Warriors. It's a public group. Everyone's welcome to join. And all we ask is that you be respectful of one another, because intolerance will not be tolerated.
Okay, very much, yes. Thank you. Thank you so much, Tina, for coming on and sharing with us today on the Richard Spassoff Show. I really appreciate you. Thank you.
Richard, and love and light to all.
Yes.
by Paranormal Talk Radio, you'll love the new Paranormal Radio app from TalkStream Live. You'll find a great selection of talk shows covering UFOs, ghosts, strange phenomena, and much more. Download the Paranormal Radio app now and start listening to the very best in paranormal talk entertainment, the Paranormal Radio app, free in Google Play and the iOS App Store.
Coming up next is an interview I did with Texas Trash. That's right. His name is Texas Trash. Well, really, that is the name of his band. And he's the only guy that I know that got ran over by a train and lived to tell about it. Now, if that's not a paranormal experience, I don't know what is. But here's the interview.
Hello, Richard.
Hey, now it sounds like we're in the bathroom talking, but the recording level's great. Now, do you hear any
great
feedback on your side?
Absolutely not.
Okay, good. So we're nice and clear. That's what counts.
Yes, sir.
So is it okay to do a 20-minute interview?
Sure. Fire away.
Okay. Now, you're the only guy that I know that got hit by a train. You rode a bus with Dr. Danger. And at the same time, we're going to come right back and talk about this. You're on the Wacky World of the Spaz here on Society Bites Radio. Thank you so much, Texas Trash, for being here today. You have quite a life, interesting life, and you're very much of a gentleman. You're very intelligent. You sing. You have a band, all kinds of stuff, right?
Well, I'm glad somebody thinks so.
Yes.
But yeah. I have a band out here in Tucson, Arizona. It's called Texas Trash and the Train Wrecks.
How did that band form? How did that band form?
Well, see, it used to be Texas Trash and the Hangovers. Then I got hit by a train, and I changed members. So we just thought it was fitting to go ahead and change the last part of the band name because it's all new members. So
now,
we went with the train wrecks because of the train accident.
Can you tell us about that train wreck, what the experience was like? That is...
Well, there was no wreck to it. I was the only one wrecked.
I know.
The train made it out just fine.
Now,
I was walking home from the pub, man, and it was raining, and I slipped and fell on the tracks, got knocked out. I woke up, and there's a train running me over.
Danger was something that they said that part of your arm came off, right? And then they had a ring above you.
Yeah. They had my hand was severed at the wrist, but it crushed a lot of the bone, so they had to take more of it off. But I've been looking at my hand in the ambulance, and I wanted the rings. You know, it was,
yeah, they're your rings.
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted those rings back.
And you got them back, I hope.
No, I did not.
Oh, jeez.
But they said if I keep water in my arm, it'll grow back.
It's just like, hey, you got hit by the train, mate. I think they owe you at least one train.
Right.
Jeez. Now, what?
In a lot of ways, it's one of the best things that ever happened to me.
How so? I know a lot of...
Well, my bandmates don't make me move equipment anymore. I got twice as many socks.
Now, you're one person, I feel, if I'm correct with this, you have a lot of faith inside you. You believe in God, and you have a lot of faith about...
Well, I'm a little confused on the faith part. I have faith in myself. I believe that I'm a good person, so I believe good things will happen to me. But, yeah, you know, there's a twinkle of faith in me.
You have a lot of courage, though, at what you do. You have a lot of perseverance is the word I'm trying to
get
out of.
Well, I'm too honored to just lay down and die, so I'm not going to let that happen. I got too much stuff to do.
Yeah, no, it's not. I get that way, too, sometimes. Life gets to be a pain in the ass, I'll tell you. And when
I'll tell you what.
You know what
I
mean.
Still there?
Yep.
Yeah, I do. Hey, you know, sometimes it's unlucky to have two arms, especially when you're around me, because I need a hand.
You, the good thing about you is you have a good sense of humor that pulls you through life. I mean,
well, the train can't run that over.
What was that? I'm sorry.
The train can't run that over.
No, it can't take that away. No, at least.
Nope.
Now, when I met you, when you were over, I think it was at the Pomona racetrack, you were in that bus with Dr. Danger, right?
Yes.
What was that experience like? What?
Well, I'll tell you. You know, it's always a big deal, like the hurry up and wait thing. You know, I had we had like 5 days downtime while the bus was being fabricated, so you have a lot of time to sit there and stew on what's going to possibly go down. You know, so the more you sit and wonder and think about it, but once you get in the bus and you're strapped in, it's a point of no return. You're going. Yeah. So this Pomona jump was so cool because we had a jump for the History Channel, and it was a bigger bus, and it hit hard on my side. Yeah, the spot they wanted to protect me. You know, they put me in the spot they thought would be the best, and I hit hard on that side. But the Pomona one, that was just lovely. It was like landing on a pillow full of feathers. You know, the catch cars were great. NBC was great. You know.
How about Howard Stern? What was he like? To me, I don't think
he
was awesome to you. Good, good, good.
Yeah. I think I didn't really care. I mean, not to say anything bad or anything about anyone.
Right.
Howie Mandel was just kind of seemed a little standoffish to me. And that white girl, the hillbilly.
That's funny you say that. Howie Mandel, I talked to for a while. He was real nice. Howard Stern was not nice to us, but it's weird.
I just felt very special that I was able to crack him up, you know, because that guy didn't need it all. You know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, inside, everybody has their bad days, right?
Yes, so, of course. Yeah, and I'm sure he was in he just rolled by our room, waved in, you know, and said, thanks a lot and everything. I'm sure he was tired. It was a very late day.
Yeah, I mean, that's like, I think, 18 hours on the set at least, yeah. And
well, not for me, but a lot of people were hard work, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, how long did it take to prepare for that jump? Around
almost a week, you know, because the bus had to be fabricated. We had to find the catch cars. It's about, I'd say about 7 days easy.
So not really so much preparation for you guys and how it's going, what's going to occur, because you don't know what's going to occur, right?
Well, there's a lot of preparation for Doc, you know, because he's the one that's knowledgeable, and he's the one driving the bus, and he's the one whose our lives are in his hands, or you know, and there's a whole other network. There's, you know, the woman helps out with you know, making sure that we have water and stuff like that. Everybody was working hard except for me.
Well, you were part of the team, and you're at that time. I just think you were kind of supposed to be laid back until you got on the bus.
Yeah, exactly. It's all part of the show, folks.
Hey, again, that was Texas Trash, and I'd like to thank him for telling us about his train wreck. Oh, boy, what a unusual story that was. Coming up next is a little skit that me and Brendan Pranowitz did. Brendan Pranowitz is a professor and a stand-up comedian. Last week, he was on our show as well, and he's a very funny man and a very sensitive person as well as being intelligent. Happy to have him here. Coming up next is our skit entitled Aliens. Aliens? We're running. Go ahead, Brendan, start it.
Okay, so Richard, you got to get your head in the camera. Question number two. What is the weirdest date you've ever been on?
What isn't the weirdest date I ever been on? Okay.
Fair question.
I'll go on. I remember one time I met this lady at a place called Cafe Michelle's in Las Vegas, Nevada.
Hmm.
I walked into the place. I mean, the place was filled with mob guys. It was, you know, your normal clientele.
You know Vegas.
Yes.
Mob everywhere, right?
And the singer that was up there that night as a guest star was D'Anthony Belmonts.
Okay, I don't know that.
Run Around Sue.
Oh, yeah, right.
Okay,
this
and no,
must
no,
have been
but,
like in the 1930s.
No. This was in the 1990s.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, okay. So I met this girl. She came up to me. She said that she was a Playboy model, which is a bunch of bullshit. And she was a doctor, which is a bunch of bullshit.
Wow.
She was really a nurse, an RN, that was really drunk.
So she leveled down.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I didn't know this, though, until I was trying to help her. And she, I decided to drive her home.
Mm-hmm.
She was in no condition to do anything, just to help her.
Right.
Okay.
She was drinking.
Drinking. So I brought her home. And in the process, she was saying that she was seeing these aliens. And she tried to jump out of my car on the strip.
Wow.
And I pulled her by the seat of her pants and put her back into the car.
She was seeing aliens.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've talked to you for a while, and it sounds like you have a long history of people thinking you're an alien. And now you're wearing this green shirt and...
I look like an alien.
Right? I was thinking you're an alien when I walked in. I was going to say something, but...
Are you intrigued by paranormal talk radio? You'll love the new paranormal radio app from TalkStream Live. You'll find a great selection of talk shows covering UFOs, ghosts, strange phenomena, and much more. Download the paranormal radio app now and start listening to the very best in paranormal talk entertainment. The Paranormal Radio app, free in Google Play and the iOS App Store.
Next guest up, Nancy Hartwell. She's a human trafficking expert. I know it's not exactly paranormal, but there are, let's say there's a lot of unknown facts about this, and it's a topic that is going on in the world, and it's very sad, also very weird. I'd just like to bring your attention to it a little bit before we close. And I hope you enjoy this short segment that we have with Nancy.
Okay, well, I'm now an internationally recognized expert on human trafficking and the 21st century slave trade, which, unfortunately, is thriving.
Yeah, that's. How did you get involved with this? What inspired you to help out people and to learn about this?
Well, a number of years ago, a good friend of mine just disappeared. They found her bicycle next to the road, and nobody has seen or heard from Ursula ever since. A couple weeks later, we heard rumors that she had been sold to a sultan in Libya.
Oh.
And that spooked me no end, because at that point, I was a pretty cute blonde myself, and I kept thinking, holy moly, that could have been me.
Well, how did, you don't know how this occurred. Your friend never showed up again, right?
No, never. Oh. But I think about her almost every day, wondering what kind of hell she has been living, and praising God that that was not me. But I started collecting stories. And once people know that you're interested in this topic, you get bombarded with stories. And so 45 years later, they managed to make it into a series of books that I've written about the victims of the 21st century slave trade. my human trafficking series available on Amazon.
Oh, yeah. Please give us your website and all that stuff so people know
okay.
where to reach you.
All right. There's a lot of information about human trafficking, the different kinds of modern-day slavery, how the predators operate, what people can do to help combat this crime, etc., on my website, nancyhartwell.com.
Nancy, let's go into some of the stories. Boy, the one you just started off with, it just gives me chills. I mean, one thing is I hope and to God she's still alive and in good health. I hope to God
yeah.
she is.
Me too, and thank you, yes.
Okay, there's so much to talk about here, and since you're the expert, where would we begin?
Okay, well, let's talk about potential targets.
Okay.
Runaways have a target on their back the size of Texas.
Okay.
Predators are looking for runaways. They're usually girls, you know, 13, 15 years old. These are prime targets. They know all the buttons to push to get these girls to trust them. And then, of course, they betray the trust, and they either put them on the street as a prostitute or they put them in a crate and ship them to harems or brothels on the Persian Gulf.
Wow. So yeah. they don't care what condition these women arrive in, apparently.
They don't care that they are destroying lives. Mm. All they're interested in is making money. And a really cute, blonde, blue-eyed girl, especially if she's tall, can retail for more than $100,000 on the Persian Gulf. And as long as people are willing to pay those prices, somebody will supply the market.
Unfortunately, yes, and that's sad. So how can people prevent this? What are some ways to... I mean, are there other people that are targets? Senior citizens, handicapped people?
No, it's mostly young people.
Okay.
For instance, young men are targeted for labor slavery, which is actually much more prevalent than sex slavery. It doesn't get quite the same press. For instance, the World Cup in 2022 will be played in Qatar on the Persian Gulf. And the facilities are currently under construction. And they are being built by slave labor.
Oh,
they send recruiters to poor countries nearby like Somalia, Afghanistan, Pakistan, promising young men fabulous wages, great benefits, and a lot of guys sign on because it's hard to get jobs where they live, and this sounds like the answer to prayer. But they get there, they sign what appear to be perfectly legitimate labor contracts.
Okay.
And they pay for their transportation. So they get there, then they immediately confiscate their travel documents. Then they lock the guys up, make them work 18-hour days under 130-degree heat. The conditions are so horrific that they have been averaging a death a day, and nobody knows.
So this is worse than even some of the concentration camps, then.
It's horrible.
Oh.
And the fishing industry in Southeast Asia is dependent on slave labor. Once again, they go to poor countries like Cambodia,
right.
And they recruit guys. They promise them the moon. And then they get there, and everything suddenly changes. And if they don't perform, they just dump them overboard.
Oh, so if they don't live up to their expectations, their lives are gone.
Right, precisely. Mm. If you see some frozen seafood from Thailand, Malaysia, Vietnam, or Indonesia, there's about an 80% chance that it has involved slave labor.
How about YouTube with all the Asian women and men that we see on there with the sex stuff? Do you think that could be in the same ballpark, or
it's often part of it. Yes, there are lots of websites that involve human trafficking. There's a whole dark web that for pedophiles, because little children are targeted. Yes, 3, 4, 5 year olds are targeted. And you asked a minute ago what parents can do.
Yes, yes.
One really easy technique is to have a family password.
Okay.
Sometimes predators will go to an elementary school when it's letting out.
Right.
And they'll spot a kid with something personalized, like a book bag or a baseball cap.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Julie, look, your mom couldn't make it here today to pick you up, so she sent me. If Julie says, what's the password, and the guy doesn't know it, she knows absolutely not to leave with him. That is a very easy and very effective technique.
Good idea. Very good idea. And that's what we did when I was little. Somebody tried to pick me up one time. And the guy was in the car, and I realized it was nothing to do with my parents. I ran. It was in Van Nuys.
Uh-huh. Good for you.
I was about 7 years old at the time. It scared the heck out of me.
As it should have, indeed.
Yes, yes.
Well, also, parents need to talk to their kids about this. We try to protect them against getting run over by saying, don't cross the street without looking both ways. We try to protect them against burning. Don't touch the stove when it's hot. But we're scared to death to tell them about predators, sexual predators that target children. Hello?
I'm right. Yep. Yep.
Okay.
I'm just amazed at your stories.
Please, please, please talk to your children about the dangers. And these predators, they know that parents have done a really good job of telling their kids, don't talk to strangers.
Yeah.
So they have devised some very sneaky ways to get around this. Puppies.
So these crooks are beginning to get really personal with the kids and close.
Yes. Well, they use a puppy.
Oh.
Okay?
Okay.
The kid isn't thinking, wait a minute, I don't know this guy. He's a stranger. They're thinking about the puppy.
Yeah, yeah.
And these predators use these techniques because they work. Oh, my puppy got lost in those woods over there. Can you help me find my puppy?
Oh, boy.
Well, we raise our kids to be kind. We raise them to love animals. And the kid is thinking about the puppy.
Unfortunately, in this world today, it's getting weirder. Kind is very important when you're in school and you know the people you know, but when you have a stranger, you got to be careful for kids, right?
Right. And like I say, parents have done a pretty good job of teaching kids not to talk to strangers. But the predators have figured out ways to break the stranger barrier. For example,
okay,
there's a girl riding a bus. A guy sits down next to her and starts groping her. She gets mad. He gropes her again. She gets even madder. Then this hero from two rows back comes over and says, hey, buddy, you keep your hands off that kid. Oh, I was just having a little fun. Well, she doesn't think it's any fun. So he dumps him out of the way. Then he sits down next to her. Have you ever told your kids not to talk to heroes?
Mm.
They were working together.
Oh, gee, a con job, but in the bad way.
A con job.
Yeah,
and in 30 seconds, he can extract from her all the information he needs. Where is she going? Is somebody going to be there to meet her? Okay? That's how sneaky these guys are. And they use these techniques because they work.
So these kids have to be really educated in school. Has anybody tried doing this yet? This is very important.
Well, there are some schools that have programs about this, but very, very few.
Okay.
Parents need to be very proactive about teaching their kids about this. And parents, you know, you don't want to set off World War III, But you do need to monitor your kids' social media sites. There are predators lurking everywhere, pretending to be another 11-year-old on the other end of that computer game.
You
okay?
never know. You never know who's going to be there.
You never know.
No.
You never know. And you can soften the blow a little bit if you say, look, I know that you know this, but your friend Madeline, she's really clueless. You need to tell her about this. Okay? That helps, you know, make it a little easier for your kids to swallow. But point out websites that have a lot of red flags,
mm-hmm.
or pictures that never in a million years should have been posted on the internet.
What would be red
girls.
Flags? Okay, what would be red flags on websites?
Okay, well, don't tell your parents about this. Mm. This is going to be a big surprise. That's for sure.
Okay.
Websites that promise fabulous, fabulous jobs. That every, like, 14-year-old dreams of, like a lucrative modeling job.
Right.
Or a part in a movie. Or participating in a hot new band. So the girl will show up for the appointment, okay?
Right, right.
And they will go to great lengths to make sure that everything looks legit. Movie posters everywhere. The guy will be on a fake telephone call, pretending like he's doing a casting of a remake of a big Hollywood hit. And then he'll finally say, okay, tell me, do you have time to sit down and chat for a few minutes, or is somebody waiting for you? She hears, oh, goody, he's taking me seriously. He wants to talk to me. I have a shot at this. What he's really asking is, have you come alone and unprotected?
Yes.
Okay? And if she says, oh, no, that's okay, nobody's waiting, then he'll sit down, chat with her for 5 or 10 minutes, get her so excited she's ready to pee in her pants. And then he'll say, let me show you the studio. And it's a closet, and he'll dump her in, lock the door, and then he'll call his friend, the broker, who's probably part of the Russian mafia.
Right.
They're into this big, big, big time.
Mm-hmm.
And within a couple hours, she's drugged and in a crate and on her way to a harem or a brothel on the Persian Gulf.
That is sick. Yes. Really
we
sick.
We need to warn our kids about this.
Yes. So it's up to the parents. Up to the parents.
Well, mostly, yeah.
And whoever, a friend, telling a friend. I wonder if that could work.
Yes.
Okay, good.
Yes,
good.
Yes. I mean, not every parent is going to do this, but
right.
kids talk to each other, and they should warn their friends about this also, because that's how word gets around when you're a teenager.
Jeez. Can you share with us some more stories? I'm just amazed at these stories that you have.
Okay, well, my book, Harem Slave,
okay.
which is the flagship book of my human trafficking series, these are based on true stories that I have collected for more than 45 years, okay?
Oh, okay.
Now, she was this all-American girl visiting some friends in Marseille, and she went to the air quarter to buy some presents for her family back home.
Right.
And she was lured into a dressing room where two men were waiting. They overpowered her and kidnapped her, and she was sold into a harem on the Persian Gulf. Mm. She could not believe it. But this is a very, very common technique.
Okay.
Dressing room, or you go into a shop, and then the shopkeeper gets between you and the door, and suddenly you can't get out.
Any way they could trap you, any way.
Any way
people,
they can trap you.
Yeah.
Or they will tell you, "Oh, you've got to see the stuff we have in the basement. It'll blow your mind." Well, guess what? You go to the basement, and you get kidnapped.
Yeah.
There are lots and lots and lots of techniques, and there are lots and lots of techniques that work, and we really need to warn our kids about these predators, because these people do not live nice lives once they have been kidnapped. On my website, I have a link to a picture of a Filipina maid in Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
She served coffee late one morning, so they poured boiling water all over her.
Ugh.
Second-degree burns all mm-hmm. over her. Okay? Heaven help her if she had done something serious.
Yeah, yeah. No, these are... They're assholes upright. I mean, they're not... they don't care about human life. That's...
You're basic... Once you've been sucked into this vortex, you're basically a piece of meat. Nobody cares what happens to you. If you die, oh, that one broke. We just have to get another one.
It's horrible.
It is horrible. And we don't even want to think about this. We kind of want to brush this whole thing under the carpet. No. This doesn't happen anymore. This is something we took care of ages ago. Guess what, people? It's still a serious, serious issue. And if we ignore it, we're putting our kids at additional risk.
Very much so. And I could tell you know what you're talking about, not only through... You've experienced this firsthand from your friend. I mean, you have been through so much, and you believe in what you're saying.
Well, not only that, but I have a friend. You would understand this. She's psychic, and she talks to angels every day.
Yes.
And she says, Nance, do you ever dream about this? And I said, yeah, two or three times a week. She says, look, I hate to tell you this, but those aren't dreams. They're memories. This happened to you in a very recent previous life. And that's why you can write about it and talk about it with such conviction, because you have been there.
So you feel that you have been there as well. Not only has your friend experienced, but you feel that you have been there.
Yes.
Okay. So.
Once she told me that, a lot of things started to make a lot of sense. Because I have been interested in slavery ever since I was 6 years old. And there was something prompting me to be interested in this, and now I understand why.
Okay, I know we're talking about slavery and stuff, but I've worked in many brothels before in Tijuana and Las Vegas, and I've known people that had even not known people. If I did, I would report them. But I know of people that have kidnapped other people and sell their organs.
Yes.
What kind of stories do you have in this area?
That is not my specialty, but I do hear stories about that every couple weeks, where people are kidnapped and then murdered for their organs, because organs, there's a big black market for them.
So again, this is something that no matter what age you are in this case, they could take you away too and do the same thing, right?
Right. But the vast majority of victims of human trafficking are young people between like 10 and 20 years old.
That's the vast. What percentage is that, out of curiosity?
Well, it's hard to get exact statistics. Yeah, these traffickers don't send in quarterly reports, you know, to the Department of Labor.
You think they would. No, we're in no way are we making fun. But we want to cry about this, because you sincerely are helping people by telling people about this. Again, that was Nancy Hartwell, a human trafficking expert. Now, to me, paranormal is something that can't be explained by science. But at the same time, it also, to me, it means something that is very weird. So paranormal could be many things. Something in this world that we don't know about that can be very strange. Well, that's my definition. So I'm making up my own. What could I say? I'd like to thank all of our wonderful guests. Tonight we had Merle Fankhauser, Tina Mahina Williams, Nancy Hartwell, and we had two segments. One from Texas Trash that was talking about his train wreck, and another one from Brendan Pranowitz, a little comedy routine that we did. So I really hope you enjoyed our show tonight. Look forward to being back this Sunday, every Sunday and Wednesday nights from 7 to 9:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Thank you, everyone, and God bless.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Richard Spazoff Show. For more episodes and information, join us online at psychicmediumspazoffshow.com or catch the show on Spreaker, iHeartRadio, iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. The Richard Spazoff Show is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more great content and shows, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com or download our free HC Universal Network podcast app from your favorite device market. Thanks for tuning in, everyone. And until next time, keep watching on the darkness.